Right, we're actually up to here, Bereshit, and we're in chapter 3, verse 22. That's the part that we have reached. Right, so there we see in the previous verse, now they've recognized that they are naked, and God has said to them that they've eaten from the tree, and they are very upset. There is this calamity, basically, which has taken place. There we have a world which is set up in such a beautiful way, and yet some kind of calamity has happened. And the form of this calamity is seen in the Kabbalah as a kind of a mixing of good and evil. That there was a structure to existence where you have the fruit, and like the fruit of a nut, and then the shell around the fruit. Klipa shomer, it doesn't say shomer. Klipa shomer, the shell guarding the kernel. And it's as if that is a normal, healthy way in which you have the kernel, which is edible, the fruit of the nut is edible, and around it is the shell, which is inedible. And that is perfectly right. What happened with the eating of the tree of knowledge made some kind of confusion, which in the image of the shell of the nut, it's as if someone has carelessly cracked the nut. So now there are little bits of nuts which can be eaten and are tasty, and there are little bits of shell, and they are mixed together. They are intermingled, and you cannot tell
one from the other.
One from the other. And that's the confusion in existence. Because it should be that that which is good and pure and holy is attractive and beautiful. And that which is forbidden and negative would in some way be repellent. As it is, let's say, for a normal healthy person, let's say with food. So if a person with some kind of sensitivity to what they eat, so they are attracted by positive kinds of food, and if there's something which is too much this or too much that, they think, no thank you, not for me. That's, whereas if they have a kind of a more primitive approach to it, you can imagine them being very, very much attracted by very unhealthy food or something of that kind. However, the result of the eating from the tree of knowledge, which caused a kind of Kabbalistic confusion in these spiritual forces within existence, is that now there is a scattering of spiritual energy, so that something which in fact is negative has got a spark of holy, of sacred energy within it, which makes it look very attractive. And so therefore, people can be in a tremendous confusion. And so that, from this point in the Garden of Eden, now comes the next stage. So let's have a look at the next stage in verse 22. Vayomer Hashem Elokim. And Hashem, God, said, Hein ha'adam hayaka achad mimenu. Behold, man will be like one of us, ladat tov v'ra, to know good and evil, v'ata, and now, pen yishlach yado v'lakach gam me'etz ha'chaim, maybe he will stretch out his hand, and he will also take from the tree of life, v'achal, and he'll eat from it, v'chai le'olam, and he will live forever. Now, the danger in this is explained that the having caused the confusion, if he now eats from the tree of life and lives forever, this is going to be a kind of a fixing of this confusion. Because the confusion is there, now there have to be processes in order to sort out the confusion. And part of those processes are the cycle of birth and death, and the whole question of development of a person and moving from one stage to another. Whereas here, the idea of eating from the tree of life, that could lead to a situation where the confusion is somehow fixed in existence. And as a result, he has to be driven out of the Garden of Eden. Now, it's interesting, and that's going to be the next line. But it's interesting that the Zohar takes this idea of the Tree of Life in a rather different way to the way that we have it here. And it says that, in fact, the problem is that he ate from the tree of knowledge first. If they would have eaten from the tree of life before they ate from the tree of knowledge, then the whole disaster would not have taken place. Everything would have been in the right way. Because if they would have eaten from the tree of life, then somehow there would not have been this confusion, and they would have been able to eat from the tree of knowledge without any harm. In fact, the Talmud says something a little bit similar. The Talmud says that all this took place on Friday afternoon. On Friday, on the sixth day of creation, now we're coming to Rosh Hashanah, which celebrates this Friday, the day when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge. Because the 25th of Elul, which will be next Monday, next Monday will be the 25th of Elul. That is actually the day, if looking at it in this traditional way, that God said, let there be light. The beginning of creation was next Monday. Then comes the sixth day of creation, which was the first Friday of creation, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the sixth day. Then Adam and Eve are created. They're put in the Garden of Eden, and then they eat from the tree of knowledge. And the Talmud says, if they would have only waited till Shabbat, then there would have been no problem. Now that's dovetailing with the Zohar. Because the idea that there is some state of special spiritual harmony, and in that state of harmony you can eat from the tree of knowledge. Because really the question is, does knowledge, even just taking the term knowledge here, knowing good and evil, does knowledge take away innocence? And the goal in Jewish teaching is that there can be knowledge and there can be innocence at the same time. And that's a very beautiful and profound approach, that there can be knowledge and there can be innocence. A superficial approach to knowledge leads to the opposite of innocence, possibly to a kind of cynicism. There's actually a story by Rabbi Nachman of Breslov which relates to this idea. As you know, Rabbi Nachman was a Hasidic Rebbe, a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, who taught very profound teachings as direct Hasidic teachings, but he also told stories which themselves were expressing spiritual teachings. So one of his teachings is about the Chochom and the Tam, the wise man and the simple man. And he tells of two people who were friends from childhood. One was very wise, the other was very simple. The wise man learned all kinds of wisdoms and he knew what they did in this country, and he knew what they did in that country, and he'd read this book, and he'd read that book. And he became a terribly unhappy person. That's how Rabbi Nachman describes him. Why was he unhappy? Talking of fashion. Because he would get a certain jacket. And the jacket was in fashion here where he lived. The trouble is, he knew that in Spain, such a jacket was completely passé. It was completely out of fashion. So he is so knowledgeable. He's not content with what is the fashion here. He knows that in Spain, such a jacket, anyone who saw it would laugh at him. So he's extremely uncomfortable sitting with this jacket. And similarly, everything in his life, even though it might seem to be all right here, but he knows that there is a broader perspective, and in terms of that, this thing is ridiculous, and this is pathetic, and people would laugh, and so on. So he was a very unhappy person. By contrast, what's he
doesn't know how to turn the fire down.
Okay. I find it's getting very hot.
All the way to the others until it's really lovely, thanks.
By contrast, his friend, the simple man, he is a cobbler. He makes shoes. And when he makes a shoe, it's got three corners somehow. And there's a lovely interchange with him talking to his wife, and his wife says, why is it that other people sell shoes for 13 groschen and they only give you three for yours? He says, what are you talking about? This is a wonderful shoe. And he's always happy. He has nothing, but he's always happy, and he's got a very encouraging wife. The wise man, I think, doesn't have a wife in the story, but the simple man does.
Because he's wise, he doesn't have a wife.
Well, because he's always unhappy, because he would say, this woman is very beautiful here, according to the standards of beauty in this country, but in Africa, they wouldn't think she's beautiful. So he never got.
They're prettier in Spain.
Anyway, so then comes a message from the king. Somehow the king finds out about these two men. And the king sends a message to each of them. He wants to see them. And the wise man gets the soldier, comes to the door with a letter saying that the king wants you to come and visit him. And the wise man looks at the soldier. He says, this message comes from the king. The soldier says, yes. Did the king give you this message in your hand? No. I got it from the captain of my unit. And did the king give it to the captain of your unit? No. I suppose he got it from the major. Tell me, have you ever seen the king? I stood guard at his palace, but I didn't actually see him. How do you know the king exists? So that's the wise man. So then you have the simple man. So the soldier comes with a message from the king that the king wants to, this is so exciting, he's so enthusiastic, this is so wonderful. Anyway, it's a long involved story. But what's interesting about it is that there's a certain stage where the simple man, who has now risen in rank tremendously and he's mixing with nobility and so on, and someone says to him, you know, look, you mix with all these nobility, maybe you should learn French, maybe you should learn science, maybe you should learn this and you should learn that. And he does. That's the interesting thing in the story. He does. He retains his simplicity. He doesn't stop being a simple man. But he now knows all the wise things that the wise man knew. But instead of it making him miserable like it made the wise man, he is able to maintain simplicity. So there is something of this. You see, when we look in the history of the Jewish people, we see a traditional community in the pre-modern period, let's say the 17th century, basically, 16th, 17th century, that's already early modernity, but nonetheless you have a traditional community, often in something like a ghetto. The ghetto began in the early 16th century and this continued through. Then you have the process of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution in France, changes taking place elsewhere in Europe, a transformation of society. And if you like, it is bringing new knowledge into society. And the effect of this new knowledge, to a great extent, was a destruction of tradition, a destruction of belief, and for the Jewish community was often very confusing. Now, there is a root which sometimes people describe as another modernity. Another route to modernity, another route to wisdom and knowledge, where it does not have to have the same kind of rejection of tradition and rejection of belief. There is a mode of embracing knowledge which somehow remains rooted in spiritual values as well. Now, there's a rather ambiguous book that was printed around 1796 called Sefer HaBrit, the Book of the Covenant. It's slightly ambiguous exactly which direction the book is taking and how it was understood by its contemporaries. But when we look at the book today, and someone wrote an article about the book as an alternative route to modernity, the book is about science, about biology, about physics, about astronomy, and it's also about Kabbalah and traditional Jewish themes, which are there somehow integrated within the book. And so you've got a chapter on prophecy and you've got a chapter on comets. You know, it's a most intriguing work.
When was it written?
Well, it was printed 1796.
Oh.
It's
Sefer HaBrit.
So a person called Ira Robinson wrote an article about it, and it seems to suggest a possibility. Do you need a pen?
Thank you.
A possibility of another route to modernity, where the modernity, the sophistication, the knowledge, doesn't take away the simplicity of faith. And that's really, in a way, it's the challenge of society at this time. The ability to have knowledge and also to have simplicity. So when we come back to the tree of knowledge and the tree of life, and we have the idea from the Talmud that if they had only waited till Shabbat, then it would have been all right to eat from the tree of knowledge. Now, you know that Shabbat sanctifies many aspects of life which during the week you would say, oh, well, this is too much of an excess, this is, why should you be concerned about having ice cream for dessert, maybe be more simple and frugal, but when it comes to Shabbat, you make a beautiful Shabbat meal and all the delicacies which are there, they are part of the Shabbat experience. So the concept that Shabbat sanctifies what otherwise is profane and it suddenly becomes holy, that's like the knowledge which also has a kind of an erotic overtone to it. Knowledge as in Adam knew Eve, and imagery in the Midrash about this, the tree of knowledge. It says the whole reason why the serpent approached Eve was because it saw Adam and Eve having intercourse together and it wanted to have intercourse with Eve. So the whole story is a cloaked, it's some sort of cloaking or a disguised discussion about sexual intimacy, whether that leads to something shameful, God forbid, or to something holy and beautiful. And so what the Talmud is saying, if they had waited till Shabbat, then it would have been all right. Then it would have been with this spiritual quality. And the way that the Zohar puts it, is that the eating from the tree of life is connecting to the divine in such a way that you can then eat from the tree of knowledge without harm. And so this is, I don't know if this is going to figure in Miller's film, but it's it would be lovely if it could. But that's a very profound dynamic in at the heart of this story, and in a sense in the heart of life for each of us. Now then, let's take verse 23. Vayishalcheu Hashem Elokim migan Eden. Then Hashem God sent him out of the Garden of Eden, la'avod et ha'adama asher lukach misham, to work the earth from which he was taken. Adam and Eve were created, originally it was just one figure, Adam, who combined both Adam and Eve, but he was created from the earth, and now he is going out of the Garden of Eden in order to work the earth. Now, if we look at this in terms of the image of a confusion which has been created in the whole of existence through the action of eating from the tree of knowledge, we understand that he cannot remain in the Garden of Eden. He has to leave the Garden of Eden in order to in order to transform, in order to sift through the confusion and put it right. So in other words, this is the first exile, really, in the biblical literature. There are many exiles. And this one is where he has to come out of that situation and therefore become a person who is involved in a world where there is confusion, and each person stands there in that situation of confusion and tries to put things right. And then it says, Vayigaresh et ha'adam. Now, that's verse 24.
To reject.
He said Vayishalcheu, and now Vayigaresh.
Yes. That's interesting. Vayishalcheu Hashem Elokim means God sent him. It could even be read, he sent him on a mission, like a shlichut.
Yes.
Yes. And then it says in a more negative way, Vayigaresh, which is the word for divorce. He drove out the man. Now, the Zohar asks a fascinating question. The Zohar says, look, in the previous verse, it says, God sent him, that's Adam and Eve, out of the Garden of Eden. What is it saying over here? Vayigaresh et ha'adam. He drove out the person. Who drove out who? Says the Zohar. Maybe ha'adam Vayigaresh et. The man is driving something else away. And the way the Zohar takes this, it like turns the words round. God sent man out of the Garden of Eden, but man drove away et. Now what's et? Et represents the Shekhinah, the divine presence. Man, through his actions, drove away the Shekhinah, drove away the divine presence. Because that is actually what has happened. That there was a situation where there was a physical world with Adam and Eve together and the divine presence together with them. Mm. However, through their actions, they drove away the Shekhinah, and the Shekhinah, the divine presence, is now receded from the world and is therefore hidden before the divine presence was revealed. And now the divine presence is hidden. So that's the way the Zohar takes this. So there is the action of God in sending man out into the world, which almost can be understood in a positive sense, in much the same way that the sages often look at exile, the galut, the exile of the Jewish people, as having a positive dimension. One of the positive dimensions that this Talmud says, why were the Jewish people exiled among the nations of the world? In order to gather proselytes, in order that proselytes to Judaism should adhere to the Jews, so a Jew goes to some distant place and there someone meets him and says, you know what, I want to join this religion as well. And so that is one of the reasons for exile. This is also interpreted as divine sparks, which are there, hidden in the world. And the fact that the Jewish people scatter over the world to different places in order to find the divine spark which is there, which they redeem by being in a place and saying a blessing, or saying words of Torah, or something or other, some Jewish dimension taking place in that area, that is transforming the world. So when we would go with our children to some little mountaintop or something, you know, so we would always have them say various verses of Torah in order to reveal godliness and redeem the sparks which are hidden here at the top of Chlamberis or whatever it might be. So that's the or the lower slopes of Snowdon where we were this year. So that idea of sparks everywhere. But then we also have the concept of man driving out the divine presence. And there's a midrash which speaks about the divine presence being driven away one step, like to the first firmament around the world, by the eating of the tree of knowledge, and then by Cain killing Abel, it's driven to the second, and then so on, taking it one, as it were, transgression after another, until there are seven periods of transgression, and the divine presence is far from the world, and then begin seven tzaddikim, seven righteous people who bring the divine presence back into the world. So there's Avraham and Sarah, they bring the divine presence from the seventh to the sixth. And then after Avraham, the next generation is Isaac and Rebekah. And the next generation is Jacob and Leah and Rachel and so on. And then we have Jacob's son Levi, and Levi's son Kahat, and Kahat's son Amram, and Amram's son Moshe. And Moshe, he brings the divine presence back into the world in the creation, in the building of the Mishkan, the sanctuary, and the divine presence in the Holy of Holies. So there we have that process of the divine presence departing from the world and being brought back to the world. And that idea of these seven tzaddikim bringing the divine presence back into the world. So there's two things being spoken about in these two verses. On the one hand, it's talking about driving or sending with a shlichut, with a mission, with a positive purpose. Adam and Eve going out of the Garden of Eden in order to work the ground, in order to transform the existence which he is a part of. Now that's, or which is a part of him. And let's just try to understand this a little bit more closely. See, within the person, if we just have a sort of schematized person, there is, on the one hand, there is a sort of an earthly part of this person. So this green dimension really links with the whole of existence And the term for this is klipat noga. Klipat noga. This is the shell which is radiant. It is a shell, and it's a sort of a force within the person, a life force within the person, and it's the stuff of nature. Let's call it that. The stuff of nature. It's the spiritual plane from which hateva, from which nature emerges. And that's inside us, as human beings, as physical human beings. There's also a lower dimension. You see, there's something which is sort of, you know, like lower than nature. And we can sometimes stoop to that and get involved with that, and that's something negative. That's when we do things which are negative in some way, that we get involved with something which is really negative. And you could say that, you know, like there's a little bit of that inside us, and we have to deal with that. That's what we have to deal with in our lives. You know, it might be the desire to, you know, punch someone in the face for some reason, but or worse, you know, that's unfortunately lots of worse things people might do. But that's the real negativity. That's the klipa. That's the lower klipa. Yes, klipa means shell, and the shell means something concealing godliness. So there is this klipat noga, putting it in English letters, klipat noga. So klipat noga is a higher level, but it's shell. And then we have a divine quality. I'm not sure if this is going to show, but this is a divine dimension, which is in the person as well. And by the fact that the person is connecting with the world, and they've got this divine dimension within them, and through the fact that they have eaten food, which is klipat noga, the stuff of nature, which gives them their physical energy, and they then use this divine force, and there's a divine force inside us, and there's also a divine force outside us, which comes in the form of the Torah, you know, so we're able to see from the Torah what are the divine steps that we should make. So we are then able to take the stuff of existence. The Torah helps us distinguish between what is klipat noga, which is positive, and what is lower klipa, which is negative. So the first thing the Torah does is tells us, be careful and how to choose right from wrong. But also, it helps us transform this klipat noga, because the thing about the drama of klipat noga, a drama which relates back to the breaking of the vessels at the very beginning of existence, and is also somehow mirrored in the eating from the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, is the fact that all over the stuff of nature, there are also little sparks of holiness. Not very apparent here because they're blue. But these little sparks of holiness, which are what become redeemed by the fact of the person utilizing the world and connecting it with God. And so there we have the positive shlichut, the positive mission of man and woman together into the world, out of the Garden of Eden, in order to reveal these sparks in existence and connect the world with God. So that's one aspect. The other aspect which is here is the way in which, as a total global history, there is the process of exile and redemption. And the process of exile is, you see, reaching into the dark world in order to redeem sparks. On one level it's exile, but on another, that's a positive thing to do. I had a very beautiful story over the summer from a friend of mine who is a scholar of Breslov Hasidic teachings. So he says, so there was a chassid, you know, maybe a Breslov chassid, who passed away, and he went to Gehinnom, went to hell. And he says, Rebbe, Rebbe, Reb Nachman, rescue me. And Reb Nachman came and pulled him out of hell by his peyot. That's the famous thing. He's got long earlocks. He pulled him out of hell and he was all right. And then there was a Lubavitcher chassid, who likewise passed away after 120 years and also went to hell. And he said, Rebbe, Rebbe. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe came and said, here you are in Gehinnom, in hell. I want you to be my shliach here. I've never heard this story before.
That's lovely.
But you see, that idea, that's really, they're going into a dark world, a world, but that is their... Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Let me turn it off. So they takes.
Could be the Rebbe.
So. That's, yeah. Finally agrees again. Extinguish. So that shlichut into a dark world, although that is in a sense exile, it's positive. But then we have the other concept. Not the fact that God has sent us out of the Garden of Eden. What we have done. Vayigaresh et ha'adam. Ha'adam garash et. That the man drove away the Shekhinah, as it's expressed in the Zohar. And so as a result of that, that's something else. That's our global problem, which we cause, and which ultimately we also have to put right. I mean, in a sense it's the same pattern, because here as well, we cause the scattering of these sparks in existence. But here it's in a way more poignant. It's the sin of man which causes the Shekhinah to depart from the world. And then comes the process of bringing the Divine Presence back into the world. And that's really the drama of existence, the quest to achieve that. Vayashken mikedem legan Eden. And God made dwell east of the Garden of Eden et hakhuvim, the cherubs, ve'et lahat hachelev hamitapechet, and the flame of the turning sword, lishmor ederech etz hachayim, to guard the path to the tree of life.
What does it mean?
Now, it's very powerful imagery here, these kruvim. This is the only time that the word kruvim is used apart, as far as I know, apart from the word kruvim in the Holy of Holies,
yes, of
on the golden ark.
Yes.
And the kruvim are something which is very sacred. They could not be seen by ordinary people, because except the high priest was allowed to come into the Holy of Holies. And the Kruvim themselves are described in the Tanakh, and also as discussed in the Talmud, as two angel-like figures with golden, angel-like figures with wings, which are facing each other, and one is male and one is female.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yes, on the golden ark.
I didn't know there was one female.
One is male and one is female.
How lovely.
And they are understood as representing the divine spherot, in which there is a female dimension. There is Malchut, which is the feminine. And so there is this concept of the male and female. Now, we now turn to a Midrash. The Midrash says that these Kruvim, they, on one level, they represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, Ushchinte, and His Shechina, and His Divine Presence, which is like male and female, the Holy One and the feminine. On another level, it is God and the source of the Jewish people, the inner dimension of the Jewish people, which is a spiritual inner dimension. But it's depicted as female, and God is the male. The Midrash says, that when God was happy with the Jewish people, the two kruvim, the two golden cherubs. You see, the English word cherub is simply a transliteration of this word. It's not a translation. It's just taken. Kof is C-H-R-B. Cherub. That's, you see, it's exactly the Hebrew word.
Yeah.
With no attempt to translate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it would come closer.
That's right. They embrace.
Yes.
When God is happy with the Jewish people, they would embrace. The two angels, these two figurines, would embrace. And when He was angry with the Jewish people, then they would turn back to back.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's one Midrash. Another Midrash says, or it's not exactly a Midrash, it's more like an account of what happened when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. So he destroyed the first temple, and then he saw the golden ark, and he said, and he ripped, ripped away the curtain from the Holy of Holies. There is the golden ark, and the two cherubs on top, embracing. And he said, look at that. These Jews, they've always been saying they reject idolatry, they only have a completely pure concept of the divine without any physical form. Look at this. They're worshipping two golden figurines making love to each other. How disgusting. I'm going to publicize this and show how low these people are, such hypocrites, pretending to have this philosophical love of the divine, whereas in fact they're the same idolaters as all of us, only we wouldn't worship something so crass as this, these two figurines making love to each other. And he showed that around different places. Of course, this idea differs from the idea that the ark, the golden ark, was hidden somewhere in the temple grounds before the destruction, which is another statement of the sages. And it also differs from another tradition that Jeremiah took the golden ark and took it back to Mount Sinai. So there are different Midrashic traditions. But now there's a question which the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked about these two Midrashim, putting them together. If this is the moment of the destruction of the temple, it must be the worst moment in the relationship of God and the Jewish people. In that case, according to the Midrash, these two figurines are not supposed to be making love to each other at all. They're supposed to be back to back. And yet they are in this embrace. It must be that the destruction of the temple and the sending of the Jews into exile is in fact deep down, it's something positive. That it's really an expression of love. Difficult as that is to comprehend.
I don't think so, because if the concept here that we are to spread at the four corners of the world those and deal with those sparks and all the rest of it, then that's what
well,
it is.
Well, that's exactly
that's
it. You see, that
is,
fits
it?
With this rather messy picture over here, just like the chaotic world that we live in. That we actually have to go out into that world, and so being in Israel, in a sense, is like being in the Garden of Eden. And there is a point when we had to.
Oh, it became a very stinking Garden of Eden at the moment.
Well, it's
in Israel, not the state of Israel.
I'm talking about Israel, not Jerusalem. Israel, which to me is separate.
But there is, so there is this, so it's interesting that this word, the Kruvim, the cherubs, is like a hint to that whole story and series of Midrashim and the comment about it, which in fact is also describing the idea of leaving a spiritual haven and going out into a broad world because there's a task to be achieved in that broad world. And then we have the flame of the turning sword to guard the path of the tree of life. And one way that that can be understood is the paradox of spirituality. That's the spirituality, I think, it's not only Jewish, so to speak. It's a universal perception that something deeply spiritual can be deeply enticing, very, very important, and yet also, in some sense, dangerous. Because the role of a human being in this world is to keep one's feet on the ground and to make supper when it's supper time and to bring up the children. And create a world which is a real world. And the tendency of spirituality can be a route which leads away from the world. And that's, in a way, that's the danger of the tree of life. You see, it's particularly the tree of life. That's the danger of the tree of life. And which, according to the Zohar, the tree of life represents Kabbalah. The tree of knowledge represents the Talmud, the laws of the Torah, the Mishnah, the discussion of what is the law, how do you keep Shabbat, how do you do this, how do you do that. In a sense, you can't go wrong with that. It's telling you about practical life, and it's giving guidance for all kinds of, all aspects of practical life, and fine, that makes sense. But once you start exploring the tree of life, which talks about images of radiance and different levels of world and soul and spirituality, angels, kameot maybe, it's something which can take a person away from the realities of this world and can lead to confusion. So therefore, there is the guarding of this path to the tree of life. Now, in the there's a manuscript tradition which now has been printed largely by academic scholars, because you know manuscripts were found in libraries, and there are all kinds of research programs studying these things. But there is a manuscript tradition. One of the published books was called Pirkei Heichalot, the chapters of the Heichalot. Heichal means a palace. And the Heichalot mean different levels of spiritual world. And the manuscripts speak about ascending to different levels of these spiritual worlds. And this is an ancient tradition going back to the time of the temple. and extending into, for example, in the 18th century, we have an account of such a spiritual ascent, which I understand in those terms, of the Baal Shem Tov, whose soul ascended to higher and higher realms, and he met the Messiah. This is an actual letter, that we have a copy of that letter by the Baal Shem Tov, and most scholars believe that it's genuinely, this is actually what the Baal Shem Tov wrote. It's a copy that someone else made of the letter, but it's generally agreed, even though there are a few different versions, and they differ, they have minor differences, but it's generally agreed, this is what the Baal Shem Tov wrote, and that was the spiritual universe that he lived in, where he made such a sense, and people around him accepted that. Now, one of the things about these ascents to higher levels is that every time one tries to go a little bit higher, there is some kind of harsh guardian stopping the ascent. There is a shomer, there is a guard, like this whirling swords, some kind of angel or force which is not allowing one to go any higher. And the way in which one has to climb higher, well, there are two ways. One way is with the divine name. Here we come back to the divine name in the Khmer. Yeah. A certain divine name will enable the person using that divine name, they can climb another step higher. The guard, it's like, you know, you show your pass and the guard lets you through.
Yeah.
And the other way is by having a teacher, a Rebbe. In the case of the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov's Rebbe, does anyone know who he was?
Yes, I forgot. It was somebody from a different, from biblical times.
Yes,
I forgot.
From biblical times.
Elijah?
Not Elijah, but you're very close. Achia Hashiloni.
Hashiloni, Ken.
Achia Hashiloni was a prophet in the time of the Book of Kings. And Achia Hashiloni was the heavenly teacher of the Baal Shem Tov. And when the Baal Shem Tov had a problem in this ascent to higher realms, he called on his teacher to help him. And so that idea of him having a teacher, a Rebbe, who will help him deal with the dangers of this, you know, what we see here, this whirling sword which is guarding the path of the tree of life, all the different manifestations of that on spiritual levels. So when we bring this sort of drama into our own lives, I think we need both those things as well. Now, the divine names, as I mentioned before, when in a kind of situation where a classical Kabbalist of the old school might have given a kameya or something, piece of parchment with a divine name or chotamot written on it. Incidentally, the chotamot, they come from this Mekava literature, this literature of ascents. That's where we get the chotamot, these seals at the beginning, which then later on found their way into kameyot.
You call it Merkava?
Merkava, yes. Merkava, the Yordei Merkava, those who go down into the Merkava. The Merkava is the chariot of Yecheskel, of the first chapter of Yecheskel.
Yes. Which Maase Merkava.
Yes, that's right.
There's a tongue.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as well. Yes, that's another dimension.
Yeah, that's right.
All these different things fit together. So the divine names are ultimately the mezuzah on one's door, the tefillin which a person wears. It's a most amazing Kabbalistic instrument, which enables a person, by a man, one's man, wearing tefillin, And by having mezuzot on the doors, it gives the most beautiful spiritual quality for everyone living in that home to be able to break through these barriers and be permitted to enter. The guardians will hold their swords aside and one is able to go through. And the other way is a Rebbe, a teacher. And the Rebbe here, I believe the Rebbe of our generation, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, gives access to us to the spirituality of life and of Jewish teaching in such a way that it should be wholesome. It's as if he were holding a door open. We have to go through. But it's as if a door is being held open so that we are able to study profound ideas, teachings from Tanya, Hasidic teachings, Kabbalistic thought, these teachings which enable us to see a more radiant and profound dimension of Judaism. And that really is the story of going out of the Garden of Eden as it applies to us today.